the evolution of novelty in biological history, and we had a wonderful introduction to physical history. And so now I'd like to talk about biological history. Now, why novelty? It turns out novelty is a problem in biology because of the following philosophical principle. One of the great reasons why I come and enjoy coming to meetings like this is because it's deeply interdisciplinary. And so I love thinking about problems in an interdisciplinary way. This is one of the principles in this for skeptics of evolution within the Catholic tradition. This is one of the reasons why they are skeptical, because of the principle of causality, which basically says the following: nothing which comes to be without a proportionate cause. And for my undergraduates, you cannot give what you do not have. And one of the things that's really striking in evolutionary biology is that you apparently have a scenario where two parents evolve an individual of a different biological kind. And so you have old giving rise to new. And so how do the old give rise to the new when they don't have the new to begin with? You see, so this is the problem that, from a philosophical perspective, evolutionary biologists who wish to integrate knowledge, to seek wisdom, have to deal with. And this is one of the projects of an ongoing program that my brothers and I are working on. It's called Thomistic Evolution, thomisticevolution.org. We just received a grant from the Donald Templeton Foundation to pursue several avenues dealing with the interface between science and religion. So we are working with the sisters from Ann Arbor to develop high school curricular resources for homeschooling and Catholic students who want to talk about the interface between faith and science. We're also talking with a group of philosophers. Dr. Carl, who will be speaking after me, is one of them. We're talking about causality and speciation. How do you bring those philosophical concepts into conversation with the classical Catholic intellectual tradition? And then we have a third group, theological, where we're talking primarily about the historical fall and original sin. How do you bring those conversations, and there's a whole lot of conversations there, into contact with evolutionary theory? So my lecture today, in the next 45 minutes or so, is going to cover a couple of parts. I'm going to talk about evolution, just the basic introduction to evolution, because I'm not quite sure what all of your backgrounds are. Then I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about how evolution actually works. How does it work? Because a lot of people don't really understand how contemporary biologists think about, imagine — it's really all about imagining — how we imagine evolution to happen. We will talk then about novelty in evolution. How do we talk about novelty? What is new? What constitutes it new? And I'm going to specifically deal with an interesting question: how repeatable is evolution? So the contingency of evolution. Because a lot of people will make the distinction between the physical world and the living world and say that the physical world, given the constraints of physics, is pretty much deterministic, in the sense that if we Big Bang again, we would end up with the same thing. Evolutionary biologists — there's an ongoing discussion about evolutionary biology — is that the case in the sphere of life? And then we're going to be talking very briefly, from a philosophical, interdisciplinary way, on the appearance of novelty. This is a work in progress. I'd like just to talk about a couple of proposals from contemporary Thomists. And what I mean here is Thomists in the last 100 years. So we'll talk about evolution. We'll begin with evolution. And what I teach is — so this is slides from my intro Gen Bio class, my favorite class that I teach at Providence College, only because I love the freshmen. They know nothing. And I have a wonderful opportunity to begin building solid foundations for 4 years of evolutionarily informed thinking, but also just a critical thinking that is at the very heart of science. So when we talk about that, there are two basic claims. So there's one is universal common descent. That means that every single living organism today is descended from a common ancestor. So it's really striking. It's the proposal in science there was an Adam and an Eve, not for humans, but for everything. then descent and modification, this is how evolution actually works, and I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about that, because what I would like to do is to show you the molecular, the evo-devo side, the molecular side, that highlights how we imagine today, in 2019, this is supposed to function. So this is, again, a contrast of special creation. So on the very top, you have individuals of different biological kinds created at a single point in time, and there is no change or transforming of a substantial variety over the course of biological history. I had always thought this was associated with the with our brothers and sisters who belong to the fundamentalist camp. It's so striking in the last 5 years how many Catholics are actually tempted to this view, especially because of the political situation in our country. So there's the assumption today that for you to be, quote, a conservative, you have to be anti-Darwinian, because Darwin is one of the primary reasons and causes for every single ill that contemporary society appears to have. So it's really striking. And the reason why we are working on a high school curriculum is because we have high school families who are involved in networks of high schooling regions where they don't have any textbooks. And everyone is telling them that they have to be creationists, even though they don't think so, because of their deep, profound awareness that the Catholic tradition honors both faith and reason. So this is part of the challenge. So with the second view, the classical Darwinian view, you have original species, original kinds evolving into different kinds. The classic, of course, that I point out is that dinosaurs, one particular branch of dinosaurs actually exists today, which is what we call them dinosaurs, we call them birds. And so this view that birds evolved from dinosaurs is very striking to a lot of people. So this is the tree of life, the major domains. You have the bacteria and the archaea. These are single-cell organisms that are as different from each other as we are different from them. And then the eukarya, those are the multicellular, complicated organisms, going from my second favorite organism, yeast. And you can see there's yeast on the side of the slide, because this is my typical spring for a slide. So those are yeast cells on the side. Those are simple eukaryotes. And then we, of course, are multicellular complex eukaryotes. Now, one of the things that I've heard as a biologist, we tend to see this in a linear fashion. We're going from nothing to something, and simple to complex. But from a biological perspective, there's just a simple diversification of life. There are more single-celled organisms today as compared to before. 99% of all species are extinct today, and which is really striking if you look at this from a creationist view. What's the reason for all of that 99%? And I've actually had people tell me that was all wastage. And this is one of the reasons why they're against an evolutionary account, because God doesn't waste. And so it's very striking that there are theological reasons for you to do this. So I prefer this view of the tree of life, which is circular. It doesn't highlight greater or less. It simply starts in the middle, and then there's just an expansion, not unlike the expansion we were talking about earlier in the universe. So what we're going to do now is we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the biology of evolution, so you have a sense for how we think about that. And This is the example that I find is most powerful, not only because it's so familiar, we know snakes, but we have a lot of genetic insight into how this evolutionary transformation is likely to occur. So we're going to talk about the evolution of the snake. Just to give you a sense, there's about 3,600 different kinds of snakes, from the Barbados red snake, as big as a quarter, the green anaconda, huge snake, probably eat that kid. Careful. Alright, so you've got these 36 different kinds of species of snake. And I know that Dr. Coons was talking about accidents and substance. And one of the things that we have to talk about, actually, in the Catholic tradition is, how do you distinguish species from kinds? Is there any difference from that, right? So is the Barbados red snake a radically different kind of thing from the green anaconda? Or is it simply just a bigger snake where the Barbados red snake is a smaller snake. So this is one of the questions for optimistic evolution is the philosophical discussion around speciation. So our current account of the evolution of snakes is that snakes evolved from lizards, and that this took about 100 million years. So you have, on the left-hand side, this is a cartoon of what we think is happening. You have a lizard with four legs. There's a lot of evolutionary pressure. This ancient lizard basically goes underground. The life underground is facilitated by certain changes. And eventually, this underground lizard comes back up. And what you see today is a snake. And so let me give you a sense of this, right? So from this evolutionary perspective, snakes are lizards that have done the following thing. They've lengthened their spinal column, right? So they've gotten really long. They've lost their limbs. They've lost their left lung. Now, this is really striking because if you look at a really, really baby snake, it has two lungs. And then as it develops, its left lung undergoes programmed cell death, which is why my students, I like studying programmed cell death because it's so ubiquitous in the biological sphere. They lose it. Now, why were they? I always, when I speak to creationists, when we talk about this, I go, did God create them with two lungs at the beginning and then, boom, the second lung gets lost a few days into development? How do you explain that? Now, from the perspective of evolution, if they evolved from lizards that had two lungs, but the tubular form of a snake is such that it really helps if you lose one because you've got to pack your luggage really tight for basic economy, right? Really, really, really tight. It helps to get rid of one of those lungs if you've got another one there. This is the evolutionary account of that. They fuse their eyelids. So if you look at a snake, the snake cannot blink at you. A lizard can. But what has happened is that the cells over the eyes of the snake have become transparent. And then you have transparent spectacles, we call them transparent spectacles, and they require flexible jaws. This is why the anaconda could swallow that kid. It can actually dislocate that jaw and open up its mouth. So the idea is that these changes facilitate a life lived underground. You can see that, right? If you're underground, it's better to have your eyes completely closed so dust doesn't get in there. But you need to have, still need to see, so you have an evolution of transparent spectacles. So now, what is the basis of this scientific claim? So first, fossils. So you have four-legged snakes that have been discovered in Brazil. And you can see that this is the snake on top and the bottom. You see its rear legs. And this is an artist's rendition of that, where you have the limbs basically being used to secure the prey before it's consumed. You also have two-legged snakes, fossils of these, so this is a snake, and then you've got its little legs at the rear of that, so you have this snake, you can see at the back, it's artist rendition, you have limbs at the back. Now, what's interesting though, and this is, so when I go out and speak to high school students or to parishioners about evolution, a lot of people go, I heard about transitional fossils. Why do we have transitional living things now? And I go, yes, we actually do. And they just get blown away from that. Because you see, lizards of different body shapes, some snake-like, have been discovered. And so you have an evolutionary tree. So you have lizards. So this is Larissa dorsalis. You can see it's snake-like. But the even cooler examples are something like this. So Larissa Edwardse, it's lost its front limbs, but it still retains. This is a living lizard, right? So it's lost its front limbs, but it doesn't have, but it still retains its rear limbs. This is Bakia. Notice it still has its front limbs, but it doesn't have its rear limbs. Now it turns out that we figured this out from the genetics. It's harder to lose your rear limbs than it is your forelimbs because the developmental program that makes rear limbs also makes genitalia. So you don't want to lose the rear limbs and lose the genitalia because then you're dead from an evolutionary perspective. So what has to happen if you're going to lose your rear limbs is you have to disentangle the genetic program that will then allow you to lose your rear limbs without losing or distorting genitalia that will prevent you from having viable offspring. And so it turns out there are a lot more lizards that have lost their forelimbs than their rear limbs. Now, these extant lizards suggest that the lizard to snake transitional forms would have been viral. So a lot of people will argue, well, if evolution involves loss, then if you lose something, you're not going to be able to live. And at least in this particular scenario, having these transitional forms reveals that you can actually function even if you are, quote, limbless. Now, for me, I'm a molecular biologist, I'm a yeast molecular biologist, so I'm particularly intrigued by the genetics and the genetic circuitry that we are now beginning to uncover that could explain how this transformation came about. So we're dealing with this evolutionary transformation, and for me to do this, I have to give you an incredibly crash course on evolutionary biology, the molecular bits. I'm going to talk about the Hox genes. So the Hox genes are the gene, a Nobel Prize was given for this. The Hox genes are incredibly ancient genes, and they're ancient because we can find them in all sorts of multicellular organisms, ranging from the fly to the mouse to us. And these genes are ordered in a particular linear sequence on the genomes of these different organisms, and they regulate the different parts of the body. So the gene that's in the front of the line controls the development of the head. The gene that's in the middle regulates the development of the middle. And then the genes at the end of this linear sequence, they're involved with the formation or distortion or change of the end. So what happens now is you can do all sorts of Lego sets with living things. So here's a wild type on the left. Wild type, which when I see that, that's the standard normal organism that you see out there at the left. What we can do is by moving a Hox gene, we can convert the antenna to a leg. So on the right there, you see two legs coming right out of the head of that fly simply because of a single gene mutation. We can do the same thing. So on the top, you have a wild-type fly, you have a pair of wings, and then you have haltiers, which are little balancing organs, which we can then convert into another set of wings. So you have a situation here where you have, instead of haltiers, that bottom fly has got two sets of wings. It's called bithorax. It has two, it's actually not just the wings, it has two repeated middle segments. We can do something like that with the eye. So PAX6 is a gene that has evolved to deal with eye formation in such a way that we convert on the left-hand side, you see that antenna? The antenna, there's a new eye growing out of the head of that fly, and on the right, we've converted all the legs into eyes. And so what we're able to do is with single gene mutations, we're able to alter in very radical ways the form of an organism, which is what people don't realize we're able to do. It's really fascinating that we can do this. And my students will end up talking about the ethics of this, and they'll wonder what a fly can look out of those eyes. And I know some of you are wondering, it's really hard to ask the fly. So that's the problem, right? That's the problem. Now, people have attempted to look to see whether or not there are electrical signals that are going between the eye. So some of these eyes appear to make connections with the brain, but the very fact that we can do this is really striking. So if you look at the Hox genes that regulate spine structure, we have the same situation. So you and I have a thorax, and then we have a lumbar region, and then you have a sacral region, and then the caudal region. We have the tail. Now it's really interesting. There are human beings who are born with tails. In India, they're worshipped as gods because they are thought to be the reincarnation of the monkey god. And it is striking that the genetic program for tails is still present within our genome, which is simply not there. You would have to have a mutation in order to trigger it off. The same thing goes with nipples, right? So if you look at typical mammals with multiple offspring, you've got dogs with lines and nipples. And I've had students go, "Father, I was at the beach, I saw this guy, he's got 3 or 4 or 5 nipples." And it's true, it's actually true. So the genetic program for extra nipples is still present within humans. And so you actually have humans who are born with the real nipple, and then they've got extra sac. And these sort of accidents actually hint to our genetic history, right? And so, and my students will go, why don't we have those extra nipples anymore? And I go, well, if you ask a woman, one kid's enough. And we are evolved to basically, they go, why two? Well, you got a spare, while one's building up, the other one's ready to go, right? So it goes left, right, left, right. So what actually happened? Why not four, father? And I go, well, and this is actually how my undergraduate degree is in biomechanical engineering. One of the things that we had to, I remember this, my sophomore year, we had a problem about, you know, we had to calculate the weight on the back in an upright human, a large-breasted woman. And what actually happens is it becomes incredibly difficult to stand straight up. The more teats you have, the more you fall over, it's maladaptive for the human back. So there are evolutionary accounts to explain a lot of what is going on here. My take-home point is that we have identified the genes that regulate spinal formation. And so what we can do is we can compare a mouse on the left and a snake on the right. And we've begun to identify the genes that regulate the formation of the serpentine form. And we can do the following things. So we can take the snake ox, and we put it into the mouse, and the mouse will lose all its ribs. So it will become snake-like, and now it will lose all its ribs. So on the left-hand side, you see a normal wild-type mouse. And in the last two, you see mice with the snake form of the HOX10 genes. We can do the same thing. You can now take HOX6, and you can induce extra ribs into the mouse. Because this is what, again, in the serpentine form, you have to have 300 or 400 ribs in order to sustain the length of the organism. We're able to do that to a mouse. OCT4, turns out that's the gene that regulates the number of vertebrae that you have in your spinal column. So snakes usually have something in the order of 300. What happens now is we're able to alter the number of ribs of a mouse. And so by just tweaking OCT4, you actually have mice that are longer and longer. So my students will be fascinated by the fact that we are attempting to transform the mouse form into a serpentine form using genetic tweaks. Now, one of the things, of course, is that legs. How do you deal with the legs? Remember, you've got to get rid of the legs. So on the very top here, you have the python. On the bottom, you have a lizard. And we know the gene that's important for leg formation in most tetrapods, and it's called Sonic Hedgehog, SHH. We don't have to go into why that name is the way it is. So in Sonic Hedgehog, it's all those flying people. They have weird ways of naming their genes, like dunce or bag of marbles. So there are genes called bags of marbles. So this is Sonic Hedgehog. Some of them are now become politically incorrect because they were like Indian head and things like that. And people are trying to change them, but the people who named them said, hey, you can't just change the name of my gene, because that was part of, I discovered that gene. Part of my prerogative of discovering that gene is naming that gene. So there's a whole bunch of stuff going on there too. But Sonic Hedgehog, if you look at the top, what we've done is we've compared the gene for Sonic Hedgehog in pythons and then in lizards, and we figured out the differences between the two. And what we've taken is we've taken the snake version and put it into a mouse. And as soon as you do that, the mouse loses its legs. Right? So you see it on the top there, it's got its four limbs. The bottom loses its legs. And so you have these single changes that facilitate radical alterations and transformations of form. So what you have here now is that we have been able to create mice, and you see when you decrease the Sonic Hedgehog, you have truncate the lips, you can get rid of the lips. So we're manipulating living organisms like Lego blocks. And these raise many other philosophical questions, but from the scientific perspective, what I hope that you get the sense is that we can now begin to imagine the genetic changes that give rise to snakes. All right. So when people say, why do I think evolutionary theory is true? Because this data is amazing. To try to explain how this all comes together, to me, this reveals God's glory. in a way that a standard special creation account does not. All right, so now novelty and created evolution. So you think about that. I have to ask, is a snake a novelty? It's a philosophical question, right? And I'm not going to answer it now because I'm going to raise this question for the following reason. Is it simply a broken lizard? And when we start talking about substantial change and other sorts of things, this is the kind of question we have to talk about. Remember, it's about losing a bunch of this stuff. It's losing capacity. It's losing the capacity to open its eyes. It basically doesn't have eyelids. It can't open its eyes. So now we have to sit down and talk about what constitutes novelty. Because, I had a creationist hear this once and he said to me, I realized something now. Snakes are lizards. Now if you say this, you will undermine the ability of the intellect to penetrate essence. So this is a philosophical view. You know, there is a deep conviction that the intellect that the Lord gave to us is able to understand things. And then when you and I see a snake, when we see a lizard, we can go, that's a snake, and that's a lizard. Now, Aquinas will actually point out the only real essence that we get is ours. It's the only one that we can specify completely because of rationality. And that most of the other essences, even though we can grasp the primary, we cannot specify the difference that will distinguish one essence from another. I think this makes sense. You can distinguish dogs and cats. Whether or not you can distinguish dogs and wolves as belonging to similar or different kinds becomes an additional issue. Right? And I was having a conversation with a group of sisters back at PC this week. We're talking about this question. And we're saying, well, our students will say, you can't tell the difference between two things that are the same. I said, no, that can't be the case. Because we are in day, and in a few hours it'll be night, and day is clearly different from night, but it's very hard to tell when day becomes night, right? And so, for religious reasons, the Jews and the Muslims will define it very specifically for the Sabbath and for Ramadan, with regards to how many stars you can see in the sky. But whether or not that is simply an accidental characteristic or a substantial characteristic, hopefully you'll see, is something we can discuss. Now, genuine novelty in biological history, I'm just going to highlight a couple, just like we had with the evolution of the universe. So the movement from non-life to life, the evolution of life, is clearly something incredibly novel. And this is the appearance of soul, living substantial form. Now, from a biological perspective, we have evolution of cells, which happens about... So, life is about 3.5 to 4 billion years ago. Evolution of cells is about 3 billion. And then this really fascinating question, from my perspective, is how do cells decide to get together to cooperate? And this is a really hot question now. And so, even in my field, which is unicellular organisms like yeast, people are driving through artificial evolution basically to try to get multicellularity there. And then rationality on the very top. This is the appearance of us. Now, how repeatable is evolution? So this is Stephen Jay Gould, who is considered in many ways the spokesperson for evolutionary biology. In his book, The Wonderful Life, he says there's a Gundunkin experiment, a thought experiment, he says, replay the tape of life a million times, and I doubt that anything like Homo sapiens would ever evolve again. The bad news is that we cannot possibly perform the experiment. This is a quote from his book. Biologists have said, well, let's see what we can do. And so they're actually experiments. So this is what's called the long-term evolution experiment with E. coli. This is Richard Lenski. This experiment has been going on for 25 years, and they are evolving bacteria. All right? And you see, he's in Michigan State. So what he does, basically, he's doing this for the last 25 years, is every single day he takes bacteria and he puts them into a brand new environment, new food. And he's been doing this every single day for 25 years. But what he does is that every week he's able to freeze these down. So we have a frozen record of evolution. And we're dealing here with something in the order of 65,000 generations, which is a lot of generations. And so what we can do is we see what evolved, And then we can go back into the freezer, pull it out again, and see, will it evolve again? You see, because now you can repeat the tape. And what he was able to show, and this is a paper that came out a couple years ago, there's a particular phenotype, I'm just going to say it's a capacity, it's ability for E. coli to eat this thing that was in the flask that E. coli bacteria have never been able to eat. And so what happens is this SIT plus phenotype has appeared, and they went back and had 20,000 generations, and they read it again and appeared again. Suggesting that it's not as contingent as it appears, at least within a certain limit. Now you have this situation too, you have independent evolution of similar lizard forms. So what you have here is in the Caribbean, these are anoles lizards in different islands, and we can trace the evolutionary history. We know that they started off with the same kind of lizard, and in each of these different islands, we can tell that there are specific forms of these lizards that appear that are comparable across the islands, and they evolve independently of each other. So this is called convergent evolution of anoles, anoles lizards in the Caribbean. And there's a paper that just came out a couple of months ago. There's this atoll in the southwestern Indian Ocean where this bird, this flightless bird, has evolved twice. So millions, I'm not quite sure how long ago, but you had a significant number of years ago, you had the evolution of a bird flew to this atoll and lost its wings. There was a tsunami that washed over the atoll, destroyed all the birds. And then another bird came in afterwards, and evolution started again. And we can compare the forms of the bird that's alive today and the bird that went extinct after that tsunami. And behold, they're exactly the same form, suggesting that you have the evolution of the same form under circumstances. So, and of course, you see the snake. The serpentine form has evolved multiple times from different lizard lineages. So what you see is it appears that in the short term, similar genomes evolve in similar ways. All right, so now this is the philosophical bit, and I'm just going to begin this as a introduction to Dr. Carl's talk, and then hopefully the panel discussion later this afternoon. How do you explain the appearance of novelty? So the closest example you have in the classical account of spontaneous generation, and there's this great book by the Sun that actually Dr. Carl suggested that I read, that I read, so our library has it, we both. And the view, of course, is that you put meat out there, matter show up. And so there was an account that went from non-living to living. And this goes up, this goes from Aristotle. Aristotle proposes a theory of this. It's an account that talks about vital heat interacting with the air under certain conditions. And then you have life showing up. Now, it's only Francisco Redi in the 17th century, 1650s or so, who's able to begin to critically deal with this. And you have these experiments that students do in high school now, where you have pieces of meat, you cover it, you put it in a jar, you uncover the jar, you uncover the jar, and depending upon what you do with the jar, you get maggots, no maggots. So what you do here is you go back to the Dominicans of the Middle Ages, for example, Albert the Great, and he's trying to explain this. What actually he does is he will talk about the celestial spheres. Now, one of the things that, and I don't have a chance to go into causality, remember how I talked at the beginning about how you cannot give what you don't have? So how does the piece of meat, which is dead, give life to a maggot? Because dead doesn't have life. And so there are explanations, which I'm not going to get into, that deal with how these more perfect beings, celestial spheres, which have the perfection of being, are able, through secondary causes, hand-me-downs, relay of existence, give it to the meat, so the meat becomes the maggot, okay? Very simplistic. I apologize to St. Albert the Great for simplifying in a radical way that kind of explanation. Now, in the 20th century, we have attempts to begin this. So I'm going to give you one, Jack Maritain, the early part of the 20th century, towards the mythic idea of evolution. I've spoken on this in the past, and I've, you know, looked at this. And so this is his view of evolution. So what he's going to do, and going to apologize for the philosophical language that I'm going to appeal to at the moment. So what you have is you will talk about, on the left-hand side, you've got elements. And the elements are composed, as hopefully you got a sense, well, the elements will constitute the body. And you have substances, and substances are made up of two principles and not two things. That's one of the things my brothers were very helpful in teaching me philosophy. It's like, when you talk about form and matter, they're not things, they're principles. They are explanatory realities that come together to explain why this being is there. So you've got form and you have matter. And people say that with regards to matter, he will impute to matter, he will attribute to matter this tendency towards, and he will call it an aspirational potency. Matter wants to do something. Now, on the other side, you've got form, and this is the efficient causality, and we'll talk about how there's efficient causality is an immanent activity. So there's a power within the form that is moving that form to also realize potentialities. And you have these, and a combination of these two, guided always by God. Now, we're not talking about miracles, so this is very important. That when I'm speaking here about the divine concurrent activity, I'm not talking about miracles. So miracles is where God acts as a primary cause. When I am talking now, God is also active, right? So this is a beautiful, this just blew my mind when I learned it in here at House of Studies, that whenever I, as a creature, realize any actuality, that in some way there's an immanent form, there's also the concurrent, God also is working to realize that, because of the essay component to it, so that's cool. Anyway, so what happens is that mixed body then becomes plant, animal, and man. So you have this account, this is Maritain's mystic view of evolution. Now, this is our brother, Mariusz Kowalczyk, who from the province of Poland. He too is on mysticevolution.org. And this is coming out next week, I think. So this is, it's out. It's the ACPQ. This is his, we've talked about this. This is a great manuscript, now paper. He's trying to give a model to explain evolutionary change from its mystic, classical, Aristotelian perspective. And I'm just gonna, this is his figure too, so it's a little bit crazy. So, but I'm gonna kind of simplify this figure. So, right in the middle, you have mom and dad. So, that circle with the cross at the bottom is mom, and the circle with the arrow on the top is dad. When I teach this in general biology, so if my students are like, how do you distinguish them? I go, well, in that case, dad's excited. And they never forget. They never forget. So there's on the right you have the male, on the left you have the female, and then on the very extreme right you have the individual, the progeny. So what actually happens, and I'm just going to simplify this, is that the male and the female organism give the essence to their infant, to their progeny. But God is also giving, also working, because he has to give the essay, the existence. This is what happens most of the time. But when you have the evolution of a new species, what you have is that God is also giving the essay and the essence, the essence, in collaboration with the powers of the male and the female. Sorry. So you have, again, it's coming out, it's not out already in the annual, in the American Catholic Philosophical Quarterly. So this is Marius. But one of the things that's striking in light of that repeatability is how do you account for that repeatability, right? So what is the teleological impulse within matter that in conversation with the environment, so this is the larger perspective, you apparently have, you put the same genome in the same environment, it moves in the same way. How do we explain that? That, I think, is the next step for what we have to do. And this is what my brothers and I and our collaborators are doing with mysticevolution.org. All right, so thank you very much. I have to thank you also. First of all, this is my lab, So this is my research lab. This is the Dead Meat Society. The reason why I didn't come down earlier is I'm running my research lab during the summer. This is our busiest time. And so I stayed as late as I could yesterday in the lab before I got on a plane to fly down here. I had to take a train back home tonight in order to be there because there are cells that are growing right now. We're so excited. We hope the place will be ready tomorrow. So this is my research lab. It's a great blessing. The Lord has given me amazing students at Providence College. And because of the interdisciplinary nature of the education and the formation that we have there, it is so not unusual to talk about God and to talk about form and matter and evil while we're running the jello to the fucking north. It's truly interdisciplinary. It's really been life-giving. Because, you know, I don't deal with graduate students for the most part. You know, I have very intelligent, very motivated. And they're informed enough by philosophy and theology to kind of ask the questions that at MIT we had no idea. We didn't have the language to even ask those questions. And if you don't have the language, you can't really ask the questions. This is one thing I discovered. You do need philosophy to do science well. And I have grant money that makes my run lab go, and then we have a John Templeton Foundation grant now that allows us to do the evolutionary stuff. Thank you so much for your time.
For a few more questions before our lunch. So,
I believe at the end you said that when novelty emerges, that God is providing not only the esse, but the essence as well.
So this is Mariusz Grabacek's proposal.
Okay. Right. Well, okay, so under that proposal.
Well, I simplify too much. I think that God is working with the parents to, in a way that he normally does not, in order to transform the essence.
Well, it seems like that violates the principle distinction between primary and secondary causality. It seems like that makes the emergence of a new species a miracle.
Well, I mean, the Lord does that now. Right? When you were conceived, he gave you your soul. And we do not. And so, in one way, we could say it's a miracle. You know, we could say that the generation of every single rational creature is a miracle. We cannot say that, and yet we acknowledge that there is divine concurrent activity in a unique way, in a transcendent way, in a different way than the way that God normally works. For example, when two dogs conceive a puppy. So I think what he's trying to say is that something akin to what happens normally, naturally, supernaturally, however we categorize what happens when each of us is conceived, is happening. You know, we have these evolutionary connections. And I'm sorry he's not here to jump. He's coming. He's actually, we're having a meeting in Providence in 3 weeks, something like that. So he's there, and I will, you know, and I think there'll be a chance for him to go into more detail. And those are the kind of questions, yes, that are important.
Yeah, it seems philosophically problematic. I mean, I understand the perspective of the human person because of the unique type of soul that we have. But if it's just at the level of non-humans, you know, it seems like we're placing God as an explanatory power other than primary cause. You know, in other words, saying that secondary causality can't account for evolution by itself.
That is the question. Now, it's really interesting because as Dr. Coons and I were talking about, this is not unique to biology. Right? This is the same thing with chemistry. So when hydrogen and oxygen come together to get water, hydrogen doesn't have the water powers, oxygen doesn't have the water powers, and yet water is water. So how do you explain that? You see, so it's really interesting. I have to keep emphasizing this is not just a biological problem. It's a lot of, and we talk about are there imminent powers within the virtual parts of the substance that move it towards a reaction? Dr. Carl and I, in the previous iteration of this meeting, had a wonderful lunch conversation about that. So it's a question that needs to be addressed. It's about appearance of novelty, again, in science, and how do you how do you provide a complete causal explanation for these kinds of substantial changes that they're substantial changes that apparently do not have a clear, efficient cause? Right, so that's really kind of where that's the problem. It's a wonderful problem.
Thank you, Father. Could you explain a little bit about how potentiality might be used to explain some of these changes? Because it seems like parents have the potential to have the legless lizard very easily with just one gene that would have to change, and so that there really isn't all that much required in order to have something that we might even call a new species.
So it's really, this word potentiality is tricky because it's usually read within the classical tradition as potentiality understood within a nature. So when you say, I have a potential, it's usually understood to be, I have a potential to realize the perfections of my nature. So when you have a lizard, the potentialities that we normally think about deal with the potentialities of becoming the best lizard, the most mature lizard they are to be. We don't usually think, because you see, a lizard with no legs is not considered, is an evil lizard. There's a privation there. And so we don't usually think of ourselves as having potentialities towards privation of our nature. So I'm using classical terminology. Now, biologically, if I didn't know any of that, I would go, yeah. Right? The mutation, by definition, is potential. You see, so now you have to take both, and you have to be able to articulate in a clear way, given these accounts of potentialities as realizations of perfection of the fullness of nature, associated with, in the account of the empirical science, especially in biology, where you have, in many ways there is a limitless potential because, well there's death. There's death, most of the potential is the death. So any change you die. But there are amazingly cool mutations that can give rise to different forms, right? Now, are we going to talk about these potentials within nature? I'm hesitant to do that, but then this is at the very end, a teleological data. So where is that potentiality? Now, Maritain wanted to suggest that potentiality is not in the nature, but in the matter. I've written on it, like, it just does not feel right. Because matter is not supposed to be determined in any way. I mean, this is the problem. He's making matter like partial substance. It's weird. All right. For the philosophers here, they know. If you read that, Suarez. You know, I guess it's really weird. You don't want to go there. If you're a classical Thomist, you want to step back. And so the challenge is within the classical account, Thomistic account. All right. How would you explain that? And so hopefully that will give you kind of just like context for how I think about potentiality.
I'm wondering if we'll talk about whether evolutionary biology is stuck in a certain pre-Socratic cul-de-sac, so to speak, that needs an injunction first to get going. There's this emphasis on genetics. So correct me if I'm wrong, but genes code for RNA and RNA codes for enzymes. And is that true for the Hox genes as well? Okay, so in other words, genetics is all about producing the raw materials for the cell. Some of the raw materials, the enzymes. So it's like we're talking about houses, and yet the whole theory is based on bricks. You know, what kind of bricks you're producing, you're changing the kind of bricks you're producing, and so on.
Everything's accidental in the biological view.
Right, so it's like pre-Socratic physics, right? We're just focusing, but all we really need to know is whether we have a snake or a lizard. What are the bricks that we're using to build the snake? And that seems like obviously wrong, because you need the builder with the craft to make the bricks into a house. And so it looks like we're missing something really crucial there.
So
where's the craft building, and how is that passed on to the next generation?
So
how is that modified? Is it modified in something different from genetic mutations?
What's really striking, I think, is in the last 20 years, if you're talking about the injection of the Aristotelian, so we have the emergence of systems biology. You and I talked about this in other counters, and where biologists are being forced to think about the properties of the whole. Because the properties of the whole, so the assumption was that if you knew all the bricks, you could build a house. And if you had a mansion, you'd have more cool dwarf bricks, and if you had a hovel, you'd have a few bricks. And it turned out that rice is 50,000 genes, we have 20,000, and rice has never gone to the moon, so there's a problem. You see, there's a problem. So it challenges there's now anti-reductionist account, because the science itself has shown we cannot explain what needs to be explained. So when I talk to biologists about form, right, part of the difficulty is doing that translation. So again, because reductionism and mechanism is so ingrained in us, right? So even I have to confess, when I'm doing my work, like we're trying to do this, we're trying to find drugs for Parkinson's right now. You're just looking to see where different proteins, they clump, they don't clump, you know, everything is little parts, and we're going to change this little bit, put this little drug, go 6 hours rather than 5 hours, and see what happens. So, and this works. It's very successful, but it cannot explain some of the big questions, and I'm hoping that, you know, this kind of conversation that is truly interdisciplinary will allow us to move past the next step.
When you mentioned like the question, like, what's the best lizard, I think one of the things I talked with Dr. I think about evolution and the origins of life and from a Thomistic perspective. And one thing that was helpful is for Aristotle, when you think of like form, you're thinking of kind of exemplars, like it's the best. But I think one way that's kind of helped me think about this is especially with respect to the prime matter and potency, thinking of form as a sort of constraint. And the thing is, when you think of it just in terms of a limiter of potencies of prime matter, it allows for some sort of diversity, and then you couple this with like nature's Aristotle's point about nature does nothing in vain. So it's interesting that if you take like a seed, right? Well, what's the natural environment for this? It's kind of a difficult question because you can take this; it grew here, not like it occurred at this place in time in history, but we can go plant in a bunch of different places. And in this place, it might be like a 2-foot shrub. In this place, when we sprinkle some Miracle-Grow on and all this other stuff, it could become like an 8-foot shrub or whatever. And in an arid desert, maybe it only gets like half a foot. And so we would, if we just phenomenologically would go around and look at all these things, we'd say, oh, these are likely different species, or maybe it's not quite as clear in some cases, but then when we start looking at the genetics underlying all of this, it's, oh, this turns out probably to be the same thing. And so I'm wondering if... I think sometimes we think too much is this a broken snake or not? Well, when we're identifying maybe kind of what's the true form or essence of a snake, I don't have the science background, but I'm thinking more of this kind of, what are the constraints that the genetics have in it? It's like, so what are the range of, given the material we've got, what's the range of form that can emerge from this snake? Okay, not the word you know. In a handy sense of emerge, but given the environment that it has to work with.
So I think just from the biological perspective, what the way we tend to think of forms, we think of forms adaptive or maladaptive. Now, maladaptive is not simply the form, but the form in a particular environmental niche. Right? So one form can be incredibly adaptive in this particular environment, and it will flourish. And you move it to this other form, another environment, and it will be maladaptive, and it will be dead. So with regards to what is the perfect form of lizard, then the proper question for that is, what is the most adaptive form for lizard in this particular environment? So which you saw that with regards to the anoles lizards that are present in the Caribbean. So there's a particular form of lizard that is ideal for living in the tops of the trees versus those that are living on the ground. The length of the limbs, the width of their finger, claws, I'm not sure the technical term, in order to grasp. So there is no ideal lizard form. That's absolutely correct. There's no lizard up there in Plato's realm that is the ideal. They're always adapted to particular niches, right? So, and yet a biologist can ask that question in regards to, in this particular environment, what is the form? Now, for example, you and I can do this today with regards to our eating habits, right? So the reason why there's an obesity epidemic is because the human form is not adapted for for the food that you have in the first form. Right? So the reason why our LDL levels are bad and we have metabolic syndrome is because we have too much food and the food is too rich. So our forms right now are maladaptive for living in this particular environment, which is striking, right? When you think of it that way, which is why it brings in the notion of virtue. Now, as a biologist, when I look at the virtues, it's striking because, you know, for Aristotle, it is in moderation in regards to the mean. Now, the question now is, are you dealing, so when you talk about moderation, of course it talks about the particularities of each individual, and each individual has particular accidental traits that are such, but there is an evolutionary edge to this because you can see we are evolved as a species for a hunter-gatherer society, which is why, you know, we have Dunbar numbers 150. So we are, our brains are ideally adapted to have only about 150 friends. 4 or 5 will be really close. Anything that more will give us psychological stress, which is why our students with the multiplication of friends on Facebook are dealing with you. So there's just too much. So now you go, all right, how do you become virtuous with regards to social media? One of the things I do with my students, you start cutting it back. So now, where is is there a need for every individual, or can we actually say something about the norm? Is there something about the species? And this is where the biology can come in and say, well, the Dunbar number is a number that's associated with the ratio between our brains and our bodies and relates to the number of individuals in a typical harem. So gorillas, community, part of the tribe of primates. So what actually happens is you say, okay, can that help us? Now this, a lot of philosophers will call this a naturalistic fallacy, that you are somehow coming up with normative principles based on biological literature. But I've talked to people, and they're less so now, less so. Humans on the way out. And there's an Aristotelian, much more realist account that's coming to view. So it's a deep question that you raise with regards to what's perfection, what's virtue, and I'm hoping actually this mystic tradition will actually allow us to bring not only with regards to philosophy of nature, but also the morals by training that with regards to virtue theory and how you can bring evolutionary psychology in particular into conversation with virtue.
Before we get a question, I'll go back. Yeah, I'm just wondering, why is a theory on special creation considered as anti-intellectual? I think I'm a molecular biologist and a molecular virologist, and I see lack of strong evidence in both theories. The evidence that you presented are explained very, very differently. So I'm just wondering why within the church is this gravity against special creation, if you like. Because I think both theories are out there and there's a question mark on what is really true or not.
So, I mean, special creation comes in different forms with different justifications. So I think one particular brand of special creation that grounds special creation, their account and their embrace of special creation on a literalistic reading of Genesis and an explicit anti-science perspective, because I had engineering students tell me, look, the fossils were put there by the devil to test your faith. Right? So now with regards to explanatory power, so now we talk about how do you advance a research program? This is the philosophy of science, Lakatos, Laudan. So the power of so now you have two rival accounts. One is special here, one is special creation, one is evolution. Now you go, all right, one of the ways you can talk about you can explain the history, and that's what I've attempted to do. But here's the other thing, too. Evolutionary theory predicts certain things about how genes will function in different kinds of species because of their evolutionary relatedness. So the reason why my students and I can use yeast to study Parkinson's, when you think about that, that's incredibly weird. The single cell that's used to make bread and beer is being used in my laboratory to study a brain disorder, right? Is only possible because of the way that we explain the evolutionary history of Saccharomyces yeast and Homo sapiens us, and the relatedness. And so I can do something, like I cannot, and I can use an evolutionary history to predict that if I take this gene and put it into that cell, it won't work. And if I take this gene and put it in that cell, it will. The problem with special creation has nothing of that sort, right? It cannot predict, because if everything was uniquely, there's no relationship between a yeast cell and a human being. They were all created individually. There is no apparent there's no explanation for why certain yeasts can be used as models for our biology and certain yeasts cannot. Now, we can do that because we will say certain yeasts are more closely related to us than others. And so it's about explanatory power, in my view, right? And so it's not because theories are compared and contrasted not just based on explanatory power in the past. It's also explanatory power for the future. If I asked your molecular biologist, let's use special creation to predict something that will allow us to do an experiment. It's hard.
I disagree with that, but I'm not necessarily in agreement that explanatory power means that one theory is necessarily correct versus the other.
That's philosophy of science thing, right? So, I mean, it's the same thing that happens with regards to when you're a jury trial, you have two competing theories, the defendant's account and the prosecutor's account. And what you're trying, how does any human being decide which one is a true account? So what we try to do is we say which one explains the evidence better. And so it's all explanatory power. So for me, this is not just a matter of biology. This is the way that reason functions. And it's part of explaining. So what's really striking, explanatory power is not just, again, the data of the past, but also predicts, well, how are people going to behave in the future, right? So the prosecutor is going to say, well, after the killing, so the suspect is this, 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 and this. So the fact that he killed the victim explains what he did in the future. And so that's the kind, so as a biologist, as a scientist, and as a Thomist, that's the way I see explanatory power. It's not just about the past, it's just how do you explain everything, which is why I believe in God. Right? Because theism has the most comprehensive, systematic, explanatory power for any other world theory. And then you meet the Savior and it changes. Right? So because then it explains your friendship with him. But before that, it explains so much more. And since you can explain how, and there are theological reasons that I propose why it is more fitting that God would have chosen to create through evolution rather than through special creation. Actually, there are theological reasons why you prefer that. The explanatory power, in my view, is more robust.
So in our Catholic tradition, we think that God is the first cause. And we conceive of God as the sheer act of being itself, as God of love, as God is made up of the transcendentals of truth, beauty, and goodness, and as the Trinity. And the second person of the Trinity, the Logos, speaks the universe and everything else into existence. And I understand that there's an evolutionary theory of language, and that the Catholic Church view is that our bodies could have evolved to the point where God could have infused soul, and our soul seem to be connected with happiness. Language, and the language requires a certain amount of biology to be there. So this is kind of like philosophy boot camp for me. So I'm just trying to get
well, this totally fine.
But is the body that was evolved to this point with the human soul to be diffused, is that the substance, and is the intellect and will of the rational soul that gets put in, is that the form, or is it something
that's a
substantial
wonderful question? Actually, so,
substantial form, and I think I just got these definitions.
Yeah. So, I'm going to make a couple of clarifying points. So, the first one I need to clarify is that God is always working. So, when the body is evolving, you would say that God is evolving the body using secondary function. So, it's not that God kind of just hangs out and is waiting for the body to show up for him to do his work. So you have to see that evolution involves what the technical term is concurrent divine activity. God is always working through evolution. He's not only just working through evolution, he's working through all of the 13.8 billion years. You know, he banged. He was the man to bang. He's the one who inflated. Everything, all of this, God is working always. And so that's the first thing. Now, if you talk about a substance, if you talk about human being, or talk about anything, or talk about any living thing, it is made up of two explanatory principles. You have form, and you have matter. Form is basic for a living substance we call soul. So kangaroos have soul. My yeast has souls. This blows my students at first. Because in the typical lay view, soul is associated with our soul. But soul is explanation for life. So if I say, all right, you know, I take my pen, and I go, why did it fall? You say gravity, and gravity explains falling. And from a philosophical perspective, I would say, why is this dead? And William here is alive. The classical account is he has soul, the table does not. So soul explains life. Now, you and I, because we come working in the 21st century, we expect what is called a mechanistic explanation. So that for thousands of years, that was enough. You're alive because you got soul. But now, after the scientific revolution, we need to know, well, what parts make up that soul, and how do those parts tinker together to make soul? Right? So, back to your question about soul and matter. You are body and soul, or properly speaking, it is matter and soul. And your soul makes the matter into your body. That's actually the way we tend to think about it properly. So every living thing has matter and has soul. So the way an account can be given is the following, is that life has been around for 3.5 billion years, and so you have all these living things, and they're living, dying, living, eating, reproducing, dying. Now, at some point, there's a diversification, there's more and more soul kinds show up. At some point in history, probably 100,000 or so years ago, what actually happened is that you've got these two human-like creatures who have body and soul, but their soul is not like your soul, because their soul doesn't have the ability to think or to choose. You brought up the word intellect and will. So it's to think specific kind of thoughts, and to choose freely. Because animals, they can think, they can choose, but they don't think or choose like we do. The idea is that two of these three human-like creatures, they made it, and they had an individual progeny. They had a kid, and the kid had a mutation. Like you saw some of these big mutations. But this mutation was a mutation that changed his brain. At the time of his conception, he was a substance that would give rise to a brain like yours and mine that had language. And because we had language, we're not able to do this. We can think thoughts and to love as the Savior loves us. So what actually happens then is that at that moment of conception, that new individual has the stuff that will allow him to be someone, someone rather than something. And God, in his providence, sees that and infuses the soul at that moment. Now, that soul, though, is a different kind of soul. That soul is a spiritual soul. It's a soul that allows you and me to do this. Now, when he grows up and he has kids and his kids are rational, he can't give his kids a rational soul. Because we don't have that power. We can't make spirit. We can only make stuff. So God, so when two of us make and conceive, what happens is that God, in his mercy, will infuse a rational soul into that embryo, that human embryo. And you go, why? Because in his wisdom, he says, things like this should have humans, should have rational souls. So that's how it comes to me. I try to hopefully get it.
Alright, it's okay. It's new. Right, so we'll take a break.
Time.
We should do some of that eating portion.